I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The Institute for Justice says that civil forfeiture is one of the greatest threats to property rights in the nation because it allows the government to seize and sell your property without charging or convicting you of a crime. The Institute and a civil rights law firm here in Philadelphia representing some property owners filed a class action lawsuit in federal court last week charging the DA's office with violating their clients' constitutional rights. The DA's office issued a media advisory saying they use civil forfeiture to protect communities against nuisance properties engaged in drug dealing. Today on Radio Times, we get two perspectives on civil forfeiture. And let me introduce both of our guests who join us here in our Philadelphia studio. Beth Grossman is a Philadelphia assistant district attorney, also chief of the DA's Public Nuisance Task Force. And Beth Grossman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Lou Rooley is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, also director of clinical programs where he oversees pro bono work, including cases involving civil forfeiture. And Lou Rooley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And Beth, let me just begin with you with a really basic question. How does civil forfeiture work?
Well, that's a very big, broad question. If I may just give a little bit of historical background as to the Public Nuisance Task Force, the previous administration under former District Attorney Lynn Abraham, I think when she came into office, I think she realized that besides direct victims of crime, such as those individuals who were held up at gunpoint or had a car stolen or a bad check written against them, that there are also secondary, almost, I would say, collateral victims who were suffering as a result of criminal activity on their block, within their community. So she created the Public Nuisance Task Force to address these issues. And this includes properties out of which drugs are being dealt. It could be troublesome liquor establishments and other various problem properties such as brothels, things of that nature. So she created this to address that.
Well, let me turn to you, Lou Rooley, because this is not just a Philadelphia issue. This is something that is used across the country, civil forfeiture, and it has some legal background or backbone. Can you explain some of that?
Sure. So civil forfeiture is as old as the nation. It began at the very beginning of the Republic, and we inherited it from England. And the theory is that an action is brought against the property on the theory that the property has done wrong, then the government may take the property. But it causes serious concerns for citizens because you can be completely innocent, you can be completely not charged with any criminal offense, and yet your property can be subject to be taken by the government. And so it's so critical that there be essential safeguards in place to make sure that there's not a wrongful taking of property from innocent, law-abiding citizens.
But are you saying that the charges are against the property, not the owner of the property?
That is, and that's hard for people to understand. They say, this is very strange. It is. It's a legal fiction that the property has done wrong, and so the action itself is brought against the property. And you see the caption of the case is the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania versus 1234 Market Street. And people say, what is that? But it is the theory that the property has facilitated criminal activity and therefore is subject to being forfeited to the state.
There are some other names, United States versus One Pearl Necklace, United States versus approximately 64,695 pounds of shark fins, just to underscore what you're just saying there. But do property have rights in and of itself? I mean, corporations now have rights to property. Does property have rights?
Well, we have the Constitution, of course, of the United States and of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and of course, property cannot be taken without due process of law, and so we start there. And when we say property, I just want to back up for a moment. We're talking about cash. We're talking about homes. We're talking about vehicles. And I think the best way to understand civil forfeiture is, let me give you an example. So we have a clinic at Penn Law School that provides free representation. And one of our clients last year, for example, were husband and wife, ages 68 and 70. Wife was a former block captain. She had been here all of her life almost. And he was a steel worker, never involved with the law, never involved with any criminal activity. Their son was accused of selling marijuana from their home, one incident of a sale and maybe a couple off of the property. Their house then became the subject of a civil forfeiture petition filed by
the parents' house.
That's right. Even though they had never been involved with the law, even though they were not being accused of any crime here, The allegations were that the son was engaged in the sale of marijuana. And as a result, the district attorney's office brought a civil forfeiture action against their house, seeking to take it from them. Now imagine that you have paid for your house all of your life, and you now are at a later stage of life. You're dealing with the fact that your son may have engaged in some drug activity. That hasn't yet been decided.
Right.
But nonetheless, now you could lose your home. And that's what we're talking about in civil forfeiture. You can lose your cash, you can lose your home, and you can lose your cars.
So back to you, Beth Grossman. What's the justification then for civil forfeiture?
The justification is besides the individual who commits the crime. Now, please note that we have to prove that there is a nexus between the activities, the drug dealing, and that there's a connection to the house, such as that, you know, buyers are coming up and purchasing drugs in the house or in the curtilage of the property, whether it's buyers are observed by police officers undercover, use of a confidential informant. So in addition to the individual being charged, this also can kind of emphasize and protect the public safety, because people around a house out of which drugs are being dealt are clearly suffering. When you can't go outside your property because people are dealing drugs on the house, on the porch that's attached next to you, when there are shootings, you know, all the time that are connected with drug dealing, you know, we have to take the interests of public safety and the surrounding community into consideration, and that is part and parcel of the forfeiture.
But how can the government, though, I mean, clearly the government can, but what, again, is a legal justification for taking, maybe even selling a property if the person who owns that property has not been charged with a crime or certainly convicted of a crime?
Well, I must note that every case is different. There are so many different variables go into each case, so they must be examined on a case-by-case basis. And let me just say that it's not the function of the district attorney's office to take people's houses from them, to forfeit houses from them. We just want the drug dealing to stop.
So it's a threat? Is it used as a threat?
Well, it's not used as a threat, but it's like here is a consequence that goes hand-in-hand with drug dealing. So it's sort of two avenues, the individual who's committing the crime, right. And sometimes the person who's committing the crime is also the owner of the property. You do have that as well, but a lot of times, oftentimes, people who own the house are certainly aware as to what's going on in the house. Not all the time, but oftentimes. But we are more than happy to work out and settle a case and not take the house from an owner who is a law-abiding owner who does have an innocent owner defense, which is also part of the forfeiture statute.
Well, picking up on that, and even picking up on the case, Lou, that you described, is your case more common, or are we really talking about some known drug dealers using properties, dealing drugs out of their house and creating a nuisance for their neighbors?
Yeah, well, there's certainly both, but the experience that I gave to you was a very common experience, and many, many Philadelphians are seeing that even though they're law-abiding, never committed an offense, that their houses are subject to being forfeited. Let's just take a look at the numbers for a moment, because I think that's really important. This is a very large program that Philadelphia is engaged in, a very aggressive program. And over the last 10 years, I was looking at the reports that are provided to the state, 1,172 houses have been forfeited from Philadelphia alone. We're not talking about an occasional crack house that is really a danger to the neighborhood. We're talking about a substantial amount of citizens in Philadelphia who are uprooted from their homes. Think about the harm to them, to their families, to their children, who are disrupted from their education. So 1,172 houses and 3,290 cars were forfeited during that same period. And then, most shockingly, $44 million in cash from Philadelphia folks were forfeited. So we're talking about a very large program that really needs scrutiny, and we'll talk about that more today.
Indeed we will. But picking up on what Lou just said, and back to you, Beth, and even back to this report from the Institute of Justice saying, or a sense sort of charging the district attorney's office in Philadelphia of being very aggressive, much more aggressive than other district attorney offices across the country in terms of going after people's property.
Well, I can't speak for other forfeiture programs in other states. What I think, obviously, it's very clear that Philadelphia is distinctly different from any of other counties within Pennsylvania. I mean, we are not Butler County, we're not Lackawanna County, and I can't even describe to you the amount of drug dealing that goes on day in and day out all over Philadelphia. So, you know, that has to be taken into account too. And this is another tool used to combat that. Now, I also must point out that I wouldn't say it's aggressive. I would say that we have so many cases involving narcotics connected to properties, whether it's commercial or residential.
But I'm wondering about, and perhaps you're talking about a handful of cases, but those cases where the property owners, as Lou described, are, you know, seem to be completely innocent of what might be going on. Let's say they're a child or a grandchild is selling drugs in front of the house, but somehow the parents, or even perhaps in this case, maybe the grandparents, could potentially lose a property. I mean, it seems like they're accused of some of a crime without having the due process that they are due.
Well, again, let me point out that, as Lou said, the curiosity of this is that we have named the property as being the bad guy. We're not accusing those within the house or the owners of the house, if they were not the ones arrested, with committing a crime. So, you know, again, as I said, it is not our mission to take houses. And I must point out, well, a couple things. First, the only person that could come in and defend in a forfeiture petition is the person who owns the house, whose name is on the deed. So oftentimes, we certainly have numerous cases where it is a landlord-tenant issue. It might be an apartment building. And of course, we have the ones where it is, you know, a single-family residence. And I have to note that the majority of our cases that end up where there is an order from the court where we have forfeited, where property is forfeited, are those by default judgment. And what I mean by that is those where the owners have passed on, they've moved away, they cannot be located, where nobody comes in to claim ownership or responsibility of the property. Then because there is no owner, just like any in any civil lawsuit, it's an automatic default as guided by the rules of civil procedure.
Go ahead, Lou.
Well, that's why this is such a troubling program. The thought that people are losing their homes by default, never even having the opportunity to be in front of a judge, to have the merits of their claims decided by an impartial arbiter, that's the very essence of due process, notice and opportunity to be heard in a meaningful way. And there's very good reasons why there's such a high default rate. It's not simply that people aren't interested in saving their property, but the process itself makes it so difficult for them that often they do give up. If, for example, let's start with currency, with cash. If you seize $500, which is apparently the average amount in Philadelphia that's seized by the police in these proceedings, it's going to cost you more than that to get a lawyer to fight back to get your money back. And you're going to have to appear in court multiple times. You're going to have to miss time from work. It's going to be a losing financial proposition. For those people who can't afford representation, they have no right to counsel in a civil forfeiture proceeding, and that is grossly unfair. And so while this looks like a criminal proceeding because it's the police are testifying against you, in fact, it's a civil proceeding.
Well, let's take a very short break. Much more to talk about and a number of things I want to pick up on as well. That's Lou Rooley, who joins us along with Beth Grossman. We are talking about a complicated but very important issue involving civil forfeiture. And I should add that there's a lawsuit that in federal court here in Philadelphia related to this issue. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The world needs great teachers. Great teachers are in classrooms, nonprofits, community organizations, child advocacy, and government. Arcadia University's School of Education is committed to developing great teachers and leaders. Arcadia's August 20th Graduate Education Open House offers the opportunity to learn more about Arcadia master's, doctoral, and certification programs in education. Details and registration online at arcadia.edu/grad open house. Arcadia University supports WHYY. Fall applications now accepted.
Diamond Dallas Page used to be one of the world's top pro wrestlers. Now he's using yoga to help athletes endure the physical demands of their sports. Diamond Dallas Page talks to guest host Terry O'Reilly, coming up on Cue the Summer from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Millions of people around the world are desperate to get into the United States, but sometimes it's just a matter of luck.
I just started bawling my eyes out, just crying, and my mom heard me from downstairs and was like, "No, you didn't," and came running upstairs. She just knew immediately what had happened.
Winning the green card lottery next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Beth Grossman, Philadelphia Assistant District Attorney, Chief of the DA's Public Nuisance Task Force. Also with us, Lou Rulli. He's practice professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, Director of Clinical Programs, and he oversees pro bono work, including cases involving civil forfeiture. We are talking about civil forfeiture because of a lawsuit last week in federal court charging the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office of aggressive use of civil forfeiture and raising some questions about constitutional rights. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Beth, let me go back to you. My understanding is that once, I guess, someone has received notice about civil forfeiture, they go to courtroom 478 in Philadelphia City Hall. What is supposed to happen there?
What's happened there is the first step is that respondents, we do not call people who are part and parcel of the forfeiture process defendants, they are respondents, come in representing the property, and the first thing they are required to do is answer the forfeiture petition. And as Professor Rulli noted, unlike criminal cases, people are not entitled to counsel, and we understand that. So, and a lot of times people will represent themselves pro se. So to the best of their ability, however they answer the petition, we accept that. And then we may do that day, or it may not be done, and the matter is continued. Once the petition is answered, we issue interrogatories, which kind of gives them which are written questions, such as occur in a civil suit, and they sort of answer them. It sort of pertains to the facts of the underlying criminal incident, and then they may present whatever information they want, proper ownership of the house, and usually then we investigate it, make a determination, is this the kind of case that could be civil, or that could be settled, or do we need to proceed to trial before a judge?
But is it the district attorney's office that decides on this? Is there a judge that hears these cases?
478, which seems to have gotten lost here, is really a scheduling room with a trial commissioner. Anything that requires judicial attention goes to our motions court in the criminal justice center. So that could be for any type of motions to compel discovery or for a trial or any type of hearing that the respondent may want.
Well, let me go to you, Lou, and even go back to this Institute for Justice report. It's highly critical of the DA's office, saying that people on average have to go back something like 5 times. If you miss one of those times, essentially, you lose out. Is that true?
Well, yes, this is possible. And so the question is, why is there such a high default rate? And who's benefiting from the forfeiture of property? And so we're going to have to really discuss a few things. One, that the law here is stacked against homeowners and property owners. First of all, the burden of proof on the government here is a very low burden of proof, just a preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt the way it is in a criminal proceeding. The burden of proving innocence is pushed on to the property owner, and it's their burden to come forward.
To prove that. So they're considered guilty?
Yeah. I mean, they have to prove that they're innocent. And if they don't raise that, it's an affirmative defense. If they don't raise it, they waive it. And that's why it's so important to have counsel. They often get started in this process by being, if they're homeowners, they can be evicted from the property even before a hearing is held, and that raises due process questions. But the point I really wanted to raise that the people are most critical of civil forfeiture about across the country is that there is a profit motive. In other words, when property is forfeited, when $44 million in cash or $56 million, $60 million is forfeited to the district attorney's office totally for the program, where does that money go? Well, it goes to the district attorney's office. It does not go to the General Assembly or General Treasury, rather, where there's accountability and transparency. And so the very people who are bringing civil forfeiture petitions ultimately financially benefit. Now, my argument is not with Beth Grossman, who's a fine public servant. But the question is, do we believe that a district attorney's office should be tainted by the fact that they get the money that they are ultimately seize and forfeit?
Well, and just I'll give you a chance, Beth. Let me just quickly jump in here. And again, going back to this Institute for Justice report, saying on average, Philadelphia's, they call it forfeiture machine, revenue equals about 20% of the Philadelphia DA's general budget. Go ahead, Beth.
Well, first, I think that number is grossly exaggerated. However, I have no decision-making authority or engage in that process to where or how or the accounting for the money is made. But that being said, what is getting lost here is, okay, those funds and the money, those are drug proceeds. So, you know, that has to be taken into account as well. The forfeiture statute says that anything that's connected with drug trafficking, be it vehicles, be it real property, be it proceeds, can be forfeited. So, you know, there has to be a deterrent effect. I mean, people deal drugs to make money. But on the other hand, you're also creating a population of zombies, and really that's resulting in further crimes throughout communities.
Well, let me toss something back at you, because under criminal forfeiture, as I understand it, assets are taken after a conviction. Is that correct?
That is correct.
In civil forfeiture, when are assets allowed to be taken?
Assets can be taken as soon as the government tries its case, whether it's before a judge or some kind of a settlement is reached. Now, I must note that there are certainly some constitutional implications that are considered and must be acknowledged within our forfeiture, our civil forfeiture statute. For example, if the underlying defendant is also the owner of the property, mm-hmm. whether it's real estate or drugs, he or she has a Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself. So because of that, we are not going to try a forfeiture case until that criminal case is disposed of, because that person should not be required to answer interrogatories, which could possibly mm-hmm. used in a criminal case. So we automatically stay those cases. We acknowledge that. If, for example, Fourth Amendment implications are also considered, for example, if the underlying criminal case, if there is a motion to suppress, is granted because of alleged illegal police activity, we will not proceed the forfeiture because the fruits are part of ill-gotten gain, you know, through improper, you know, police activity.
Let me go back to your rule. I mean, is that an argument to get rid of civil forfeiture and just make it criminal?
Yes, I think many believe that we have as a tool for law enforcement criminal forfeiture. And the beauty of criminal forfeiture is that you have to demonstrate that the person who owns the property has indeed committed the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. That is our legal system. And that person will have the right to counsel in that proceeding to make sure that truth emerges and that the right result comes out. But that's not the case in civil forfeiture. And as the DA noted, the high default rate certainly doesn't give us much assurance that the right results are being achieved. And the fact that people come to 478 not knowing anything about what civil
this is
forfeiture
478,
is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they come there for the first time and they think that, well, they'll see a judge and that they'll get their property back. In fact, what they see is they see the district attorneys there. There's no judge. There is a trial commissioner who schedules matters, but the district attorneys are giving advice to the people who are coming in order to try to get their property back, and that's not a good situation.
But you're saying there's no one there representing, or maybe some of the law students depend, sort of representing the property owner?
That's right. And so they see only the district attorneys, and the district attorneys try to give them some information, probably try to avoid giving them advice, but nonetheless, the only information they're getting is from the district attorneys.
Go ahead.
All right, I need to clarify that. We do not give our respondents advice because we are not permitted to give legal advice to people. However, my DAs are trained. We are not there to pull the wool over respondents' eyes because they are not represented by counsel. I emphasize that firmly with my DAs. Respondents, whether they are represented or not, are treated with respect. We explain the process to them and what they can do. They are given information that they could try and seek counsel, such as through Mr. Rooley's program or elsewhere, or the bar referral service. But we are not there, you know, to advise, but we are not there to pull the wool over people's heads. I need to really emphasize that.
Well, let me just respond quickly, and I'm not suggesting they're there to pull over the wool over anybody's eyes, but what people do see when they come is that they don't get a hearing. They get handed ultimately a voluminous amount of interrogatories that they have to respond to. If they want to preserve their rights, they really do need to file pleadings and to have, this is a complex legal matter, and they're not getting that. They're not getting the information they need. Even, you know, when the petitions begin, they don't begin with a notice to defend that begins every other civil action in Pennsylvania, which tells people what it is and tells them where they can go and get legal help. Indeed, even that is missing from this process. Everywhere we turn, the process is weighted very heavily in favor of the government and against law-abiding individuals whose property has been taken and who have every right to be in court to defend their property.
And we are talking about the civil forfeiture. And again, that's Lou Rooley, who joins us along with Beth Grossman. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We want to get your comments about what we're talking about. Beth, let me go back to you. And as you said, you're not exactly sure how much money the DA office gets from the civil forfeiture program. But one of the criticisms, again, going back to this Institute for Justice report, is that the Philadelphia spends nearly 40% of its forfeiture revenue on salaries, including the salaries of the very officials doing the seizing and the forfeiting. The idea is that, I guess, that if that's a moneymaker, it could be a reason for being even more aggressive with property owners. Can you respond to that?
Well, let me just say, at no time under this administration or the previous administration has anybody, any of my superiors, ever said to me, you're not generating enough, you're not taking enough. Never, ever in my almost 8 years as heading this unit. Again, now, if you look at the Drug Forfeiture Act, it does permit any money that is forfeited to go back to use to enforce the Controlled Substance Act. Mm-hmm. So it's not unreasonable that that could be used to pay for salaries. But beyond that, I can't offer any further details.
But the fact is, this is a very aggressive program. Again, when we look at, just comparing Pennsylvania, for example, there are over 6,500 petitions filed by the DA's office in 1 year alone. In Allegheny County, which includes the Commonwealth's second largest city, Pittsburgh, some 200 petitions were filed in 3 years. And so you see that the Philadelphia program is totally out of proportion, not only in Pennsylvania, but frankly in other municipalities around the country. When we looked at Los Angeles and you look at Brooklyn, New York, Kings County, you see that the amount of money that's being forfeited to the district attorney's office from cash, from cars and from homes is just out of proportion. And so that really raises serious questions.
But could it say that Philadelphia has a big drug problem?
Well, there's no question that Philadelphia, like all urban centers, have drug problems. The way to solve that drug problem is not to take property away from law-abiding, innocent citizens. They stabilize communities. It's to work with them. We keep them in their homes, and we should think about what happens when they lose their homes, or think about what happens when they lose their cars. Do they lose their jobs because they can't get to work? When they lose their currency, can they not pay bills, and does that begin to cause even more harm to the community?
Go ahead, Beth.
Well, again, as I stated, you know, the majority of our real estate property cases are settled, whereby the owners are allowed to stay in the house. The landlord may keep the property. You know, there may be certain things like a tenant has to be kept out, or you cannot let X, Y, and Z come back into the property. As for, you know, cars, if you were dealing drugs out of a car, this is a consequence. Now, again, every case is looked at individually, okay? And if there is an innocent owner, be it car, be it, you know, real estate, we are more than happy not to seek forfeiture of that particular item, whatever it is. Either we return the money, or we just settle the agreement, or we withdraw the forfeiture petition against the house. But let me tell you, there are those cases where those houses are absolutely infested with drug dealing, okay, that have gone on. And in fact, many of our cases where we have settled them previously, there are subsequent arrests where it happens again. Mm. And every once in a while, there's been a couple cases where we've given them even a second chance again. So every case is different, but there are certainly those properties where the district attorney's office has no choice but to go to trial. Have we lost forfeiture cases when we go to trial? Absolutely. Of course we have.
But the fact that there are so many of these cases in Philadelphia, does it say that there's just a huge problem of illegal drug dealing and nuisance properties in the city?
Yes, it does. It
more
really,
than Pittsburgh, for instance?
More than Pittsburgh.
Which is a smaller city.
Which is smaller, of course. I mean, yeah, we do have a horrific problem of that. And let me note that, you know, the information about drug dealing properties comes in, the majority, from community members, okay? It might be anonymous, but people on the block, on their block, they know what their surroundings are. They know what the bad house is, okay? And it's not fair to them. People are scared. They will report things anonymously, but that's where the majority of information generates from. And the people, the law-abiding people who care about their, you know, their homes and their block, they can't get lost in this, and they are.
Well, but I wonder, if nuisance properties obviously are nuisance properties, if there's sort of ongoing drug dealing, I'm assuming we would all agree that that's a problem in a neighborhood. The example you gave is of a couple that sound by themselves innocent of what happened outside or by
exactly.
a family member.
And it was not an uncommon problem. I mean, that
well,
we
I guess
see
that's
this
the question you describe, is that common?
I think that there's no question Philadelphia is dealing with a drug problem like every urban center, but there's no evidence that it's more than Los Angeles or more than New York City. We have to ask ourselves, why is Philadelphia's program so out of proportion to others? You know, we just went and watched in horror what happened in Texas, in Tenaha, Texas, and in Bradenton, Florida, in which we had these large programs of seizing money and property from innocent citizens. Why? Because of this profit motive that is behind civil forfeiture. Mm. You know, Minnesota just this year passed a law that said they will not take property unless there's a conviction, criminal conviction of the property owner. If there's a problem, there are plenty of law enforcement tools to go after that problem and take care of it. In fact, civil forfeiture was intended to go after kingpins, to go after drug cartels, to really take the tools of the trade away from those who are engaged in that large-scale enterprise. And instead, it's been unleashed against innocent citizens of Philadelphia here in large numbers, out of proportion, and people who have been law-abiding citizens, and that isn't right. And people say, how can that be possible? Mm. And is that the kind of city we want? The birthplace of liberty in our nation. Do we want to have a system that takes away private property? Like
about
that.
A minute before our break. Go ahead.
Well, I respond to that as, yes, we have an enormous drug problem. And think how demoralizing it is for people on the block because of prison overcrowded. Somebody gets arrested for dealing drugs out of a property because of prison overcrowded or nominal bail. You know, they're back on the street in the same property dealing within 48 hours. And if that's not demoralizing for law-abiding citizens on the block, then I don't know what is. People are fleeing the city every day. So we want to keep the law-abiding citizens here and let them know, you know, that we care about them. Now, the law as it is now, it is an in rem action, as Professor Rooley explained, where it's against the property. And that's, we work within the confine of the law, of the drug forfeiture statute.
Well, we're going to take that short break. There's so much more to talk about. We're going to take that short break, get back to our conversation. And that's Beth Grossman, Philadelphia Assistant District Attorney, Chief of the DA's Public Nuisance Task Force. Also with us, Lou Rooley, Practice Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, Director of Clinical Programs, and again, oversees pro bono work, including cases involving civil forfeiture, working with Penn Law School students. And I do want to get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Read some emails and some tweets as well. Radiotimes at WHYY.org or at WHYY Radio Times.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. If you are among the thousands of people in our region who are affected by heart disease, now you can find Penn Medicine Heart and Vascular Care in Chester County at Chester County Hospital. They've brought the strength and experience of Penn's Heart and Vascular Center to the community. More about Penn Medicine Heart and Vascular Care in Chester County at PennCCHeart.org. Penn Medicine. Your life is worth Penn Medicine. PennCCHeart.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephen A. Rick Clark tells us about his new novel, Sweetness Number 9. In the 1970s, a flavor chemist works on an artificial sweetener that becomes a popular sugar substitute, but he worries it's causing obesity and other problems in the country and in his family. And Adam Rogers tells us how to avoid a hangover. His new book is Proof. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Where you go to know, it's not just a catchphrase we throw out there because it's cute and it kind of rhymes. It's a statement of who we are and what we do at WHYY, keeping you informed all day long wherever you are, at home, in the car, at the office. WHYY is there, on the radio, live online, or via podcast. The news you trust with the variety and depth you deserve from our award-winning journalists. WHYY, anywhere you go, where you go to know.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about civil forfeiture, actually something we talked about a couple of years ago when Isaiah Thompson from the City Paper was on the show talking about this issue. We're talking with Beth Grossman and Lou Ruley, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Just a quick recap, several property owners in Philadelphia have filed suit in federal court accusing the district attorney's office of violating their constitutional rights by its use of civil forfeiture. They had their property taken away, even though they say they were never found guilty of a crime. The DA's office says civil forfeiture is an effective way to take down drug traffickers, and this is what we're talking about. An explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Beth, just a quick question to you, but what about those truly innocent people? You know, yes, they own a property. Yes, someone was, you know, selling drugs in their front porch or something like that, maybe once or twice. Some of these cases that we've been reading about, how did they get protection under this civil forfeiture?
Well, certainly we look at every case with all the information that we gain, including police paperwork, answered interrogatories, the answer itself, and we are certainly not going to forfeit those cases if we have an innocent owner. Whether we withdraw the petition or work out a settlement agreement, you know, that's not something that we seek to forfeit. We're seeking to forfeit ones where an owner knew or consented or allowed the drug dealing to go on.
Just to you, Lou, quickly, just to jump in here, and then I'll give you a chance to respond. This lawsuit is saying that these people's 14th Amendment, their constitutional rights were taken away. They want a dollar, but they want to change the law.
Yeah, because I think everyone's upset about civil forfeiture. Everywhere I go, people say, I can't believe this is happening. It's not right. This isn't our system of justice, that in fact you can have your property taken this way, you can be evicted from your home without a prior hearing, that this high default rate, because there's so many petitions being filed, people being lost in the system. You know, I'll tell you another quick case that we had. We had a 77-year-old woman in end-stage renal disease. She was out of the house three times a week for dialysis, and apparently somebody dealing drugs ran through her house. She left her doors open because her neighbors would help her. And they left the drugs in the house, and as they were chased by the police, even against her, a civil forfeiture petition was brought to take her home from her. Now, again, we come back to criminal forfeiture. The DA has the right to bring an action after they prove somebody's committed a crime, and if they can prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, then they can go after the property. But this is not right, to go after innocent citizens like this who are struggling in a difficult world, in a difficult environment. One other thing I just want to point out is that while the state law permits the use of civil forfeiture, it doesn't mean that the district attorney's office has to use it in the kind of numbers that it's using it. And that raises real questions of whether or not it's being done uniformly. Because is civil forfeiture having a disproportionate impact on people of color, of people of low income or moderate means who really don't have they're vulnerable and they don't have the resources to fight back. And as you know, we've been in the middle of a scandal on rogue officers. Seven officers of the narcotics unit are under federal indictment. And I hate to think about the property that has been forfeited based upon testimony and reports of officers who are now under federal indictment.
Yeah, go ahead, Beth.
Well, let me respond to that. First of all, forfeiture cases are not brought based upon race or gender or sexual orientation. These are things that are connected with drug trafficking, okay? That's what that is about. With respect to these officers who are under indictment, when the district attorney's office chose to stop using these officers as witnesses, I returned probably hundreds and thousands of dollars of money for which forfeiture petitions were pending. I withdrew forfeiture petitions against real property that involved those officers. So I think that needs to be put out there.
Is there, though, a difference between, from the DA's office, or even from your perspective, a difference between trafficking and the occasional drug sale? Is that sort of all one and the same?
It's all one and the same. I think you have to look at each case. I mean, again, every case needs to sort of be evaluated upon, you know, what is going on. I mean, if it's one case involving, you know, one blunt of marijuana, you can't, for example, you can't take somebody's car for that if it's a de minimis amount of marijuana. And that, in fact, is written in the statute. So, again, it's really, truly a case-by-case basis that dictates what happens with these cases.
Let me get some callers in. Now, we've got, looks like Todd from Media joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Todd. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, thank you, Marty, for bringing up a show about a topic I didn't know I was upset about.
There you go. Go ahead.
but I don't understand the difference between civil and the question I asked, I think, got answered. So my question now is, I don't really understand what's the difference between the civil and the criminal, because the property is not committing the crime. The individual is committing the crime. And when that person has been prosecuted or taken away or whatever, how is the house still guilty? Mm. The person's gone. In the case of this couple, the property was innocent. The people didn't know what was happening. So how can that be a deterrent to the people who were doing it that they didn't know were doing it?
Well, yeah, it's well put, Todd.
That's my question.
No, it's a good one. I want to hear from both of our guests. I'll start with you, Luuli.
Well, I think, Todd, you've hit it right on the head, and that's why criminal forfeiture is favored, and we want to use criminal forfeiture. We want to say if you're found guilty, then your property can be up and subject to loss. But for folks who are innocent, you're right. The theory, though, is it's against the property. The property can still facilitate a crime, even though the person who's accused of that crime is ultimately found not guilty. And it's due to a technical, really, difference in that the burdens of proof are different between the civil process and the criminal process. It's hard to explain. Yeah. Most people don't understand it, and most people don't agree with it. And it's not right, and we need to put an end to civil forfeiture.
Go ahead, Beth.
Well, I certainly think that the neighbors who are within whatever block out of which property drugs are being dealt probably do agree with it. And when I receive, you know, voicemails from someone who says, thank you, I could sit on my porch again, well, that says a lot. And it is. I understand it's a very peculiar concept in the law.
It is a peculiar concept. I mean, the problem is you've got individuals who are dealing drugs. And yes, they're using they're using a car, they're using an apartment or a house. But it's the individuals who are committing the crime. Yes.
Well, this is how the statute was created. It is in rem action, whereby the law says it could be brought against the property itself. And, you know, it's an oddity. I understand that.
And it's an oddity that began in the beginning in the maritime days, in the customs. You know, the idea that if there were customs violations or piracy violations, right, you could seize the ships that were causing those problems. And that made some sense. But in the war on drugs, it's been unleashed against citizens who have nothing to do with it. And so that's where we need to make substantial change.
We have a tweet from Oscar. He says, there's a vacant house on my block being used by transient folks for drug dealing using. I've reported it, but nothing happens. This, of course, is the other side, which is
correct.
Nuisance properties where the problem doesn't get addressed in any way, shape, or form.
Again, I mean, we can only forfeiture petitions will only be brought where there is an arrest or a connection to the property, to the house. So if there is an arrest there and it is brought to our attention, that's something we will look at and to do it. Again, I must note that it is the police department or other law enforcement agencies that will go out and investigate the drug dealing, you know, as opposed to us. So I do not dictate police manpower. That is certainly up to the police department. But if there is an arrest there and it's something that we have knowledge of and if it is appropriate, we will take action under the Forfeiture Act.
Let me get Dan from, looks like, Winmore to join our conversation. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I understand the need to protect the community, but that should not abrogate individual rights. And by seizing the property under civil forfeiture, it seems like you are limiting a person's ability to use that property, whether they get a home loan or if they actually have the cash, to hire counsel in a criminal proceeding or other proceeding. So it seems inherently inequitable to do such a thing. Is it possible to reform the system to do something like escrow it or put the, you know, protect this property somewhere so that if there is a judgment against it, it can be turned over, but not to sort of do it a priori? The other thing, it seems like you could extend this and say, well, the action is against the property and not the person, so get out of my courtroom, you have no standing. It seems like this is a real stretch. How can you satisfy both needs but make this more equitable?
Well, let me see if Lou Ruley can respond to your comments.
Well, I think your question raises what the great need is, and that is for reform of civil forfeiture laws. And so I hope that out of this discussion, one of the things that will happen is that our state legislature will really undertake substantial and serious reform of our state civil forfeiture law. And that is, how do you satisfy competing interests of society to be safe in your neighborhoods and in your homes, but at the same time to make sure that your property, which you've gained through a lifetime of earnings, is secure from government takings, particularly where the government has a financial interest in actually benefiting, getting the money from what it takes. And so we have great work to do, and our state legislature needs to hear from citizens throughout Pennsylvania. We've got to change the burdens of proof. We've got to put the burden where it belongs. We've got to require convictions before we take property. There's many things we can do.
Go ahead, Beth.
Well, again, those with, you know, examples such as Mr. Ruley's, those are not the houses in which we will end up seeking forfeiture. I mean, again, as I said before, it is not our mission to take houses. We just want the drug dealing to stop out of those particular properties. And if a homeowner, whether be it landlord or residential homeowner, doesn't know what's going on in your property, you really should. You know, in the example of a landlord, look, I understand you can't be aware of what your tenant is doing 24 hours a day, but if you are an out-of-state landlord, you either better have, pursuant to city code, you know, a local manager who could go by and see what's going on, or get yourself there and understand. You know, we have enormous vacant properties, abandoned properties with many out-of-state landlords that create a lot of problems, you know. So this is just kind of part of this is to be like, look, you have to be responsible for your property.
Let me get Clark from Arlington, Virginia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Clark. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I have a question for Ms. Grossman. My understanding is that you mentioned that many of the forfeiture cases are settled. My understanding is that when a property owner settles a forfeiture action, they are sometimes required to give up the ability or the right to assert an innocent owner defense or other constitutional defenses they might have in future forfeiture actions involving the same property. So in other words, today I have to give up future rights that I might be able to assert if a problem comes up with that property again. Is that true, and does that seem fair?
Clark, just a quick question. Are you from the Institute for Justice?
I am from the Institute for Justice.
I thought so. Just checking.
I'm not answering that question.
No, go ahead, Beth.
I'm not going to answer that question.
You're not going to answer?
No, I'm not.
Oh, well, will you answer it, Luke?
I would love to answer it. You know, this is an issue that I've raised with the district attorney's office, and we've gone around about this. So, yes, this demand that a person give up their future right to assert a statutory or a constitutional defense is really a serious, in my judgment, due process violation. This shouldn't happen. District attorneys should be all about procedural justice and making sure that everybody has their day in court, ultimately. And so this is a serious issue. Mm-hmm. I know it's the subject of litigation currently, and the district attorney may not want to talk about it right now. But this idea of waivers is a very troublesome area. We saw it again in Tenaha, Texas, where they were demanding that you give over your cash and waive their as a waiver, and therefore they wouldn't prosecute you for a crime, or they wouldn't send your kids off to a DHS organization. And so waivers are very dangerous, and I just think there's no excuse for using them.
You want to say something, Beth? Go ahead.
Well, you know what? I just completely lost my train of thought.
You did.
Okay. I'm so sorry.
Happened to me. Clark, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me squeeze one more caller in. We have Mark from Tioga joining us. Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Somehow I feel that Lincoln Steffens must be laughing somewhere.
Lincoln Steffens?
shame of the cities, 1902. He was the one who described Philadelphia as corrupt and contented. Why is it that in a case where, one, charges are not brought, two, charges are withdrawn, or three, an acquittal is achieved, why isn't it that property isn't automatically returned in the city of Philadelphia? I must ask.
Well, it's a good question, Mark. Let me toss that back to you, Beth Gross.
First of all, real quickly, I remembered what I was going to say.
Okay.
And with respect to that, look, nobody is forced to settle a forfeiture case. Anybody is free to have a trial before the judge that hears our forfeiture cases. Now, that being said, if something is seized, such as money or a car, there is also another avenue that people can seek or must seek to get back their property, which is called filing a return of property petition under the criminal rules of procedure, whereby they file a motion to get their property back.
Anything you want to add, Lou? We're almost out of time here, but yeah, go ahead.
That's part of the problem as well. I had a client's piggy bank. The daughter's piggy bank was seized by the police. There was $95 or so in that piggy bank, right? Clearly not part of any... And ultimately, she got it back. But it took over a year, and it took legal counsel to do it. So there is a process, but it's a very difficult process. It's a long process, and it's one that needs reform.
We could go on, and I do want to thank you both very, very much for joining us today in Radio Times. It's always good to have a hearty, meaty debate with two people that are so civil and respectful to each other. So I want to thank you both for coming in and also just how well you behaved during Radio Times.
Thank you.
I do appreciate that. Beth Grossman, Philadelphia Assistant District Attorney, Chief of the DA's Public Nuisance Task Force. Lou Rooley, Practice Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, Director of Clinical Programs. He oversees pro bono work by students there at Penn Law School, including cases involving civil forfeiture. For more information about Radio Times, go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, and also download podcasts of the show. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. And do